For those who came out, thank you. My name is Adam Pruden. I am a former research fellow at MIT's Sensible City Lab, which is a lab that develops creative solutions using new technology to make cities and everyday life just a little bit better. I am joined today by Albert Wong, who is a 3D information artist and recent resident of iBeam, a art and technology organization in New York City. So the title of the presentation is Detached Messages, Spatial and Immersive Systems. So if you're here, you're probably interested in immersive media, interactive media. You may be a designer, you may be a developer. My portion of the presentation is going to be more on the design side and theory. So the goals are to introduce new theories and perspectives on immersive media, provide a basic set of ideas to reference for designers who are working with immersive and spatial media, by grounding the subject in a history and revealing some patterns and trends. So I'll be sharing some projects from the Sensible City Lab related to the development of new spatial media, and then Albert will be doing the same with his work. And then we can follow with a Q&A. So I have a background in architecture and visual design, so the past 3 years I've been trying to explore the overlaps of of these two disciplines. And so for me, detached messages is a way of understanding how physical and digital media are not only converging, but also how they're moving into space, becoming loosely bound to substrate surfaces, and sometimes suspending in midair. So to kind of explain that a little bit further with this illustration, the image on the left is kind of the traditional form of media. It's attached to a surface like a billboard on a building. It has a substrate surface, and it's pasted, so it's not detached. In contrast, the image on the right is removed from the substrate surface. It's floating in the air. So while this may sound like something from a science fiction movie, it's actually been happening for a very long time. One of the earliest forms of visual communication, the smoke signal, in fact, is detached. It's communicating a message in the air. About 2,000 years ago, the ancient Chinese invented fireworks. Moving forward about 4,000 years, or 2,000 years, in the 1930s, we began to see aerial advertisements through like the Goodyear blimp, skywriting, and towed messages behind airplanes. Then in the 1950s, again in the 1980s, and then with Avatar in 2010, we see these peaks of popularity in 3D cinema. So one thing I've been trying to understand is why is there these peaks of popularity in 3D cinema and then it begins to fall? And I think part of that is because it remains a novelty of wearing these goggles on your face and this faking of floating media, where humans really want to interact with it in a more direct way instead of sitting in a fixed location and wearing equipment on your face. So this idea of virtual detached messages hit an even more extreme peak in the 90s when we moved into the idea of virtual reality. So instead of just having 3D glasses, we wanted to completely immerse ourselves in a virtual world rather than by going inside and seeing that anything was possible. So why didn't virtual reality take off? Well, there's several factors. One is cost. One is that the equipment is undesirable. So instead of just glasses like traditional 3D cinema, there's helmets and gloves and cords and controllers, and it just became very fake and disconnected from reality and disregarding the human body itself. And an interesting statistic is that since 2004, the number of Google searches for the words virtual reality has dropped by 80%, so there's just an overall disregard to the field. And now media is becoming more networked, it's always accessible, its data is growing, the analysis and visualization is growing. We can turn it on, we can turn it off to certain levels. and it reaches us at smaller and both larger scales. It's embedded in our buildings, and it's with us in our pockets. So what's next? I like to use this illustration of the evolution of the television screen to predict where media is going. If you see, in the 1950s, the TV was this big box in our living room. It had three channels. It was in black and white. You couldn't do much with it. It wasn't very intelligent. And then up to today, the television is now with us in our pockets. It goes with us wherever we go. It knows about us. It knows who our friends are. It knows where we are. And it's significantly more intelligent. So if this trend continues, what's beyond the cell phone? And part of my research is predicting that we're moving towards physical pixels itself. So something that's more physical, more lightweight, more responsive, more networked, more spatial, immersive, controllable, and customizable, but at a smaller scale than ever before. So if this were to happen, if we were to move towards a system of pixels as a common form of visual communication, it's going to impact space. So you can see the image on the left is an example of traditional media. If this is a city grid with buildings, the red portions are the messages slapped to the sides of buildings. Now, if we move to a volumetric form of information, it's going to start filling the space and breaking off of the buildings. So if that occurs, it's going to impact how humans interact with media. So traditionally, media is more visual. We look at it, but we don't always directly touch it. And that's changing with technology. We're moving towards more tactile devices. But if media were to really fill space, our body would interact with it directly, and the media would begin to block our doorways and our pathways. And so those are some factors that designers and developers have to consider. So through the past three years of doing this research and looking at hundreds of case studies from artwork that's detached to advertising, there were trends that started to appear based on materiality and behavior of this media. So I started to group these case studies into different categories. And the six that I came up with were projection, light, solid, particulate, virtual, and physical pixels. And now these are just the six that I observed, but there's some overlap in depending on the project, and there's even probably some categories that I haven't explored too much further. So an example of projection is this piece by Jenny Holzer. She's projecting words onto the Guggenheim, and with projected images, they can move from surface to surface, and there is still a level of attachment. They are attached to the projective device itself, the projector, so there is a source of origin, and they're not really completely visible until they hit a surface, but they're more fluid and they're not so static. The next category is light. This is an advertisement by Sprint, but it's using prolonged exposure to create images with a light pen in space. And this is something that Picasso also did in a series of photographs, I believe in the 1940s. And while this is interesting, it still requires a camera device to capture it using prolonged exposure. Our eyes can't do this ourselves. And if they did, then I think our world would be pretty chaotic. The next category is solid. So solid forms, and this is an image by photographer Matt Seiber, who photoshopped out the poles of street signs. And what I like about solid forms of floating media is that they have a greater defiance of gravity, and they have a higher level of tactility, so humans want to interact with it more. The next category is particulate. So particles like fog, rain, dust, and sand can act as reflectors of light and become materials for communication. This is an example by Minima Forms, which is an architectural communication group based out of London. And here they are projecting texted text messages onto fog. And with particulate forms of media, it tends to be more ephemeral. It's less predictable because you're dealing with natural elements, shifting winds, and things like that. Now, this category, which I kind of briefly mentioned going through the history of detached messages, is virtual. And I kind of put it outside of the other groups because it's not really as physical as the other categories. It's the tricking of floating media. It's faking. So sometimes I include this in the presentation, sometimes I don't. And the final category, which is the type that I've been studying most at MIT, is dots of light, which are also called physical pixels or voxels for volume pixels. And these are usually found in groupings, so they come together to form images and 3D arrays in space. And they're seen a lot in art and these 3D volumetric pixel arrays. But one thing we were exploring in our lab is what happens if they become even more autonomous, and then even eventually what happens if they become a common form of communication instead of existing as a novelty. So we're trying to predict that dots are the future. They're both simple and complex, and they can also be very versatile. So again, just a reminder, this is our kind of the basis of the research of looking at this trend and seeing if we are moving towards a pixel form of communication. Maybe we're advancing technology so fast that we're just skipping the pixel altogether and there's going to be something else, but there's definitely, we're moving towards something. And what I like about dots from a design perspective is that it's the basic building block of forming an image, and we've been doing it since the beginning of time, really, when we looked up at the stars and started connecting the dots to form constellations. And artists like Van Gogh and Lichtenstein have also been forming images with dots through the technique of pointillism. From an architectural perspective, the dot is like a basic building block. It can create the immersive spaces around us. So as an architect, it can be a tool for building. And then the dot is a good convergence of the synthetic and the real, creating like a synthetic atom that can sense and respond at the same time. So the following are the projects at MIT that we've been attempting to make physical pixels, media systems, immersive systems more real, and gaining a greater understanding of how humans will interact with these systems. So the first project, which I think was introduced about a year and a half ago as a concept video, we released a video on YouTube. It had about a million hits, and it's called FlyFire. It's an adaptive 3D pixel array facilitated by a swarm of small autonomous aerial vehicles carrying LEDs. So I'm just going to share that concept video if you haven't seen it. Thank you. So since that video was released, over the past year, our lab, the Sensible City Lab, has been collaborating with MIT's Aero Astro Lab. So I was teamed up with an engineering student, and we worked together to actually build a flying pixel. So now we could have this 3D array not attached to these LED strings. And so we went through several iterations of the design of the 3D pixel, which is basically a flying helicopter with an LED. But the technology was the same. It was set up using a series of motion tracking infrared cameras set within the testing space, and then there's an infrared LED on the circuit board of each helicopter, a color LED on each helicopter, and then it was all housed inside of a ping pong. This was a quadrotor design. Ultimately, we've been working more with this design, which is two propellers and then two passive wings. Each helicopter is pre-programmed, so there's a routine that's coded, and then we install that program onto each of the helicopters, and then using a transceiver, we can turn them all on at the same time, and the routine is activated, and then they're monitored. Their positioning is monitored with the motion tracking cameras. So here's a small clip of what I was allowed to share of 9 flying helicopters. And so they were all launched at the same time. There was a lot of turbulence, so they kind of were pushed around a bit. And I think that one at the bottom didn't even make it too far off the ground. It's probably one that I built. But in conjunction with developing the flying helicopters, we began to realize that we weren't considering the human factor of what happens when we have the system built, how will humans interact with it. So we went through a series of 3 really small projects called Bits and Bodies, and there's 3 projects inside that series to begin to understand how humans will interact with a 3D pixel system that's very fluid and filling space. It's kind of like the Star Trek idea, beam me up, Scotty, but more like a pixel duplication, where perhaps we could scan a human body and then duplicate it in another place in using just flying pixels. And because we are replicating the human form with this material that's a little more flexible than the limitations of the human body, then you can begin to manipulate it in different ways at different locations and different scales. So the technology that we tested for scanning the human bodies is not new at all, but the application in which it would be used for is something that we thought was novel. The first human scanning project that we did was a 1-day workshop with Google's data artist Aaron Koblin. We had 20 students construct 3D light scanners, and it was comprised of a webcam, an iPhone, and a micro projector. And here it is finished. So the 3D light scanning, the projector would project a series of 3 horizontal line images onto a subject. It could be an object or it could be a person. And then the webcam would take photographs of those projections and save it into the iPhone. And then the students could upload those 3 images into processing and using a plugin called 3Phase. And then what they're left with is a pixel cloud version of themselves. So then the idea would be that we could extract those XYZ coordinates in that pixel cloud and translate it into the FlyFire system. So then the next project built off of this first project, the workshop only produced static 3D images, where we used the Kinect to add motion and do it in real time. So this project called Pixel Vision, which we collaborated with Dan McDuff from MIT's Media Lab, and he helped us build a program of scanning the human body in real time and then producing a pixel cloud out of that. So using that theory and that concept that we could capture and duplicate someone in real time using pixels. And so while the Kinect was a lot more powerful than the makeshift 3D light scanners, we wanted something more robust. The Kinect is still, the range of it is quite small, and we wanted to produce something even more dramatic in capturing human motion. So we thought, what better way of capturing the movement of a human than through a ballet dancer? So we collaborated with Roberto Ballet, a famous ballet dancer from Italy, and produced this project called Dancing Atoms. So what we did is we all went to London and we did a 3D body scan of him. And this, it really was strange because it was a homemade 3D body scanner at this guy's house. And it just felt like we were back in the 1980s. And so we combined the 3D body scan of Roberto with a traditional motion capture of his movements using Vicon cameras, a Lycra suit with the reflectors on him. And we produced a concept video of Roberto as if the image on the left, he was in real life dancing, say, in New York, and then on the right, maybe his pixel version using the Flyfire system is duplicated in Austin, Texas. So you can see the pixels are appear at different resolutions. So you can go from a very dense pixel and then a lower resolution. And because he's made of pixels now instead of human form, he can respond in different ways, such as gravity and even shifting forms and possibly filling up the entire room. So that last image of him transforming into filling the entire space is really kind of the idea of what we're going towards, this convergence of space, of media, and the human form all into this one idea using this pixel communication system. So that's all I have. And I'm going to give it over to Albert, and then we can do Q&A. Yeah, it's sensible.mit.edu/flyfire or /bits. The last one was /bits. But if you Google Sensible City Lab, you can find all the projects on there.
Hey everybody, I'm going to do the central room.
Hi, my name is Albert Huang. I'm a 3D information artist, and if you don't know what that means, then you're not alone. The reason I know this, and I'm going to take a moment to brag here, is because recently my business card was published on the internet. In fact, it hit number one on Reddit. Has anyone here seen this business card before? Yeah. So I keep getting lots of random phone calls for people who think that I'm a front-end developer who takes himself way too seriously, like I'm a code ninja or something. No, but information artist means I do like artwork with the context of information, and there's a long history of it. I just confuse people by putting in the context of this. What do I do as a 3D information artist? Today I'm going to be talking about three projects that have to do with that idea of being an information artist. I just work with 3D spaces. I try to make 3D spaces that are engaging and really involved. And instead of just working with conventional performance stuff or dance stuff, I usually involve information technologies. I do come from a background of dance and performance stuff, too. And today I'm going to be talking about three projects, or three different things. The first is the Lumarca, which is that thing right there, and I'll change the lights to show that later. It's a volumetric display, creates 3D objects in real space. The second is a project that I'm working on called Spatial Computing, which imagines a future of that's really augmented reality saturated, and how can we interact with our machines if we have 3D content in front of us? What sort of design paradigms do we have to redefine? And the last thing I want to talk about is me dancing. I do a lot of urban-style dance called Liquid, which is like rave dancing from the 90s. And I'm going to talk about like why I think not only that particular form, but a lot of other forms of art are really, really important in the development of spatial media when that actually comes to fruition. So the first thing I want to talk about is Lumarca, and I have a non-YouTube... This is an installation that we did recently at the IBM Art and Technology Center, where I was an honorary resident. And I need to get the audio. First-person shooter and bring it to the theatrical stage, or bring it to some sort of like space that is the space around our bodies.
There's always two moments of sort of awe when people see the project for the first time in real life. It's like, wow, what is this thing that is occupying the real world, that's moving in real three dimensions? And then they sort of like get into, wait, how is this happening? And then we explain to them that it's just yarn and projection, and it's sort of like a second blowing of their minds.
Materials-wise, the string, this is 4 pounds of white cotton yarn, so it was like $50. The projector we're borrowing from IBM, and just like a lot of time. The tape, the gaffer's tape is, I mean, gaffer's tape isn't cheap, so the tape on the ground is probably... $20. So, all in all, I mean, like, compared to a lot of other volumetric displays, this thing's dirt cheap, right? No spinning plates, no, like, crazy robotics, no LEDs. Some people, they first see it, and then they feel cheated or something. They, like, immediately in disbelief as a first response, and then they, like, need to coax themselves into acknowledging that this thing actually exists in front of them.
So you're probably wondering how this is all done. So I will show you. What we're doing is we're projecting out an image that looks a lot like this. It's an animated image. And it's just a bunch of slits of light. And each slip of light corresponds to one and only one string. It's a very specific calibration. Once you get that calibration in line, that means you can point to any string and say, I want this string to be blue from here to here, and no other strings should be affected by that decision, right? Here's a top-down view, and on the right hand over here, this is where the projector sits, and it's sending its light through these things, and each one of these hits only one, it intersects only one string. So this is, here's some footage of us building it.
time lapse. It took us about a week, a lot of time. The thing over at IBM was 15 feet in each dimension. One of the nice things about the technology is it's really scalable. It's really easy to get big and small. All you got to do is move the projector forward and back. This is the exact same design actually right here. And I'll dim the lights in a bit to show you, to give you a better sense of what that looks like. But basically, you string up all the string, and then right now what we're doing is we're aligning the strings to match the projection. And once you get that in alignment, you basically have a map of 3D space with strings, and you can use that to create three-dimensional objects. Now, in the video, Matt talks about the second blowing of people's minds. It is truly a new experience when you see this project. It never translates on video because the project is all about taking a two-dimensional image and like stretching it across the third dimension. So taking a video just slams it back into 2D and undoes our work. So it's one of the challenges of the project. But the thing about the project is that like when you think of digital media, I'm assuming that everyone in this room, 100% of the digital media you've ever seen has been mediated through a screen, right? Which means that we have this like cognitive sync between thinking computers and thinking screens. Like screens are how I see computers, right? Now with mobile technologies, now with mobile technologies, it's changing, sort of. But in the sense that we're inputting different material, we're not only inputting mouse and keyboard, we're inputting geo, we're inputting like photos, and we're inputting a lot of other, like I'm checking into some place. But for the most part, we're still getting back. We get a little bit of audio, but we get 2D screens back, right? And I think that's what's at root at what makes this so striking when you stand in there. You walk into that room and immediately you can acknowledge that this is a three-dimensional object, and it's a digital object, right? And that is blowing of the mind one. And the second one is that it is just string. And it's this question of detachment that, like, it technically all media has to be attached to something, right? And here the media is attached to the string. But the fact of the matter is that the volumetric content is not, it's only being pointed at or insinuated at by the string, the light on the string, right? The actual content itself is in the space between all of the string, and we're just using a light as a visual trick to get you to feel it. And that's what's like, that's what's so engaging with it when you see it, that it is sort of, oops, it is both, right, just string, and it is something totally digital. So this is a photo of this DIY kit here. I didn't know if I was going to be able to bring it all together, so I brought this photo anyway. So if you want more information about the project, hit it up at www.lumarca.info. And also if you want to come by afterwards and see either see more of it or you want a business card from me, either one of my business cards, I will give those out. But I'm going to turn the lights off for just a sec so you can see. It's probably going to be hard, but I'll show you. I don't know. Can anyone see that? Come on by afterwards and I'll give a little bit more of a demo of how volumetric content looks in real three-dimensional space. I'm not done yet. All right, so the second thing I want to talk to you about was spatial computing, which is a series of videos that imagines a future, an augmented reality, saturated future. In fact, I opened this up in a different tab because I anticipated this. Maybe not. And in this saturated future of, the idea being that in the future someday head mount displays work perfectly, and so does body tracking. Google has just announced that they're doing some like goggle stuff, and I'm pretty sure that's augmented reality based. And really the whole craft of this particular video was to create three-dimensional environments that were digital that felt just as real as real objects. So a lot of the interface choices that were in this video are designed on things that we do in real life. In real life, I point to objects, right? In real life, to move things, I put my hands on them, grasp, and displace my hands in space. I mean, these are things that we learn as toddlers, right? These are things that are like kind of obvious to everyone. But if you spend, I don't know, 100 hours a week in front of a screen, you you might not, you know, those might not be the first options that come up when you're trying to design these interfaces. So this is a little preview from Spatial Computing Part 3, which is as of yet unpublished. But the idea is that the other one was about shopping for coffee tables in your living room, and that the context of having a coffee table in your living room is important to see three-dimensional space. And this one is about watching a football game or watching home media in your living room. So you'll be able to see stuff either on the floor in front of you, or as you'll note here, I scale it up so that I can see it in the world all around me. Now, all of this obviously is just like design concept stuff, and I don't have all the technology to do it myself, but the idea is that these things aren't too complicated. Like, given the existing technology that we have, I don't think it's too far down the line. I think it's in the future, but not in the way too distant future. And another thing I talk about is how you can get your own camera angle if you need, whenever there's a play. So the manipulations of this space are also based in how we interact with real physical objects by pointing, and then there's some shortcuts that that I sort of made up combining my understanding of digital spaces and physical spaces. And lastly, I guess I'm going to be talking about just my dancing. I come from a background in performance. I do a type of dance that was born out of the rave scene in the 90s. So when electronic music was when it was bubbling up, a lot of people started doing like illusion-based dancing. And it is my conviction that because this is the birth of electronic music, it's also the birth of electronic movement. It's this sort of cultural synergy that, I hate that phrase, but it's some sort of, something's happening there, right? Something really interesting is going on. And I'm working with a guy who is writing his thesis on the on the relationship between HCI, human-computer interaction, and liquid dance, because he also, I've convinced him also to believe that there's a really important relationship to establish there. I'm just going to show an image here done by one of my friends. One related style of dance is called tutting, which is back in the 80s, they saw a lot of King Tut Egyptian stuff. So it's basically dancing with 90-degree angles. And the people listening to the podcast can't see that I'm dancing. But when you do this, you build a... There's a physical framework that's constructed, and the whole trick between this is basically you just need to memorize the framework and then travel within that framework. So this is a very visually pretty example of this, but you know, dancers, there are lots of frameworks out there, not just only from dance, but and not just this form of dance, right? And then the right side is this triangle grid that I can't even begin to wrap my head around. That is so cool, but that is years from me. He's a very good dancer. You know, I mean, I come from a performance background. I did a lot of lighting design, sound design, theatrical direction, and devised work, and dance, and magic, and stuff. And I think that a lot of this stuff, you know, a lot of my inspiration comes from these different sources. And Adam comes from architecture, and I just love talking to architecture people because they have such a weird, different perspective on three-dimensional space. And I just want to do a quick poll. How many people here would say they spend 40 hours a week in front of a screen? 40, right? This is probably a day job or whatever. This is like, and those are screens include like your laptop, your desktop, your tablet, your phone, these are screens of rectangles of light that you look at. Keep your hand up if you are 60 hours a week or more, you think? 80 hours a week or more? Television, movies too, right? 90 hours? 100? 100, 100 hours, maybe. So if you sleep 8 hours a week, or 8 hours a day, that means you have 112 hours a week of waking life. So if you spend 100 hours in front of a screen, that means you spend 12 hours in three-dimensional space, which isn't to say that you're like your jobs or livelihoods are like going to be threatened, because obviously 2D space is like here to stay for a very long time, right? I mean, like, we have a very long history of printed media and imagery media and stuff like that. But when three-dimensional space comes along and people are going to, they're just going to shove you this work, they're going to be like, hey, you're really good with computers, why don't you, like, you know, do this stuff? I would definitely suggest talking to dancers, talking to architects, talking to a lot of other a lot of other different forms of artwork that have been around, crafts that have been around for a really long time that have to do with engaging in three-dimensional spaces, have to do with creating choices and creating experiences for people. And you know, that's where most of my inspiration comes from, and that's where I definitely suggest you guys take a look at that for. So once again, this is my information. If you ever want to get in contact with me, just search for like annoying business card and you'll get this. Or come up to me afterwards and we can talk. So I think we're going to open up to questions. Oh, before we do that, I just want to say vote for us or rate us. Rate this panel. That's what I was supposed to tell you to do. So rate this panel and ask us questions and come up afterwards and whatever. So I guess we're open to questions, yeah?
Is this the only mic that's
on? Oh, yeah.
If you have any questions, you can walk up to the mic in the center aisle.
Hi, I'm Chuck Fletcher. I've worked for an advertising agency. We have a emerging technology lab there. Super curious about the position of the projector. Is it, like, how are you getting to all the strings, and is it coming down from the top? How does that work?
Yeah, so you can actually see in here, it's the position of the projector. We have two methods for building it. One, we either clamp the projector down and then move the strings to hit it, and then two, we build a structure and then find a place, find the hot spot for the projector. For this installation that we did at iBeam, we... Yeah, for that, oops, there we go. For this installation, the projector is like sitting off to the left here. It's hung up on the ceiling and it's just mounted there.
You have that with more than one projector?
Like there's some complications because you add more projectors, you have more light and you...
Cross-light.
Yeah, you need to still make sure that no light hits any two strings. It always has to be unique. So, I mean, we've played around with that idea. And you can also use two projectors as an array. So there's one here and then one over here. And then sort of double your resolution horizontally.
My question is also about the Lumarca. And what do you see as the future of using that in digital media or visual communications?
It is like a very... I'm not really sure. Oh, so this is a prototype for the DIY kit, right? And one of the ideas is to get this thing out into the market so that other people can start developing onto it, to get other ideas onto it, hook it up to different hardware. We have a Kinect hack that we did where, you know, it takes three-dimensional information from your body and then displays it in a three-dimensional way in here where there's like a little stick version of you. Dancing around as you dance around. But there are other ways to... I just want to get it out there and get other people designing different sorts of software for it, basically. And then we are working out some details with some people in Guadalajara to do a 60-foot tall version down there for a digital festival. We have a lot of... We're growing and we need to update our website and all that other awesome, fun stuff that comes with growth.
And then, not to monopolize or anything, but have you two thought about collaborating with any of your projects?
Come again?
Have the two of you thought about collaborating with any of your projects?
Yes, absolutely.
we were talking, I mean, definitely talking about working on Lumarca together, and I want to talk to you about dot stuff.
Hi. Are you familiar with Chuck Hoberman?
Chuck, can you say the name again?
Hoberman. H-O-B-E-R-M-A-N.
No, I'm not.
I envision this grid as being able to be shrunk or enlarged very easily. If you look up Chuck Hoberman,
yeah,
he invented things to be able to be...
Is he an artist? Is he?
He's an engineer. Okay. To be unfolded in outer space for structures.
Yeah, that's his work. Cool, thank you.
I have some other things that I... When in your talk, I wanted to chat about. The peaks in popularity in three-dimensional content. I heard once that it was about recessions. Anytime there's a recession, there seems to be a peak in three-dimensional space, like 3D space. I don't know if this is true, and I think it has something to do with the idea that you need to escape. We were talking earlier that digital spaces are usually thought of places to escape, and I actually don't know how much of this is based on the fact that when we use digital spaces, we're always looking at a two-dimensional medium. Because if you look at the history of 2D media, photographs, cinema, like printed word, usually you have to shut off your physical 3D body to engage with it fully, right? So I'm wondering how much of getting into a computer space is about escaping, and then the promise of 3D being a more involved escapism. I think that might be what some of the correlation between recession and 3D.
And I think to build off of that, the word detachment is of media physically detaching. There's also, like he was saying, there's a level of humans using media to detach from reality. So and where is media going? Is it becoming more real? If it's moving into space, does it make it more real? Does it make reality less real? Are we psychologically detaching as well?
Right. Thank you.
I got a question about, I guess, practical applications. I mean, while this is art is beautiful and my brain exploded, what about medical or sort of communication? What are some sort of practical use cases that you guys are really trying to push towards?
Well, practical applications. That's a very good question.
Sorry.
I get two reactions when I bring up floating media. One is, that's amazing, and another is, that's terrifying. Why would I want that? So I think when you're creating something that gets those two extreme reactions, and it's always the same, it's always terrified or amazing, I think it's the job of the designers and developers to create a system or a set of rules or a framework that makes it easy for people to customize. So it needs to be something that responds in a way that keeps the media on the side of the amazing part, and calm when it needs to be, and exciting when it needs to be, and maybe even terrifying if that's what people are into.
So there's a lot of work right now being done with Kinects for physical therapy stuff, because having a computer read out where your body range of motion is, that's like really important. And I guess a lot of like autistic work is being done with autism. It's much easier to, working with autistic children, it's much easier to engage with them with physical spaces. So I think there's a lot of really intelligent people out there who hate screens. You know, this isn't just me and my intelligence could be questioned. But so with regards to all this stuff, like you do sacrifice some sort of resolution for the Lumarca, and there we have been building renderings and stuff. You know, I'll pull up a rendering, see if I can find it, of Lumarca with like thousands of strings. But the higher resolution you can get, the more visually the higher resolution you can get and the faster you move content inside of it, the more recognizable these objects are. And, you know, ideally, at some point, we might be able to do the Princess Leia thing. I don't know if that's, like, totally crazy, but it might be able to, like, beam out a three-dimensional object, and you could record me in one room and present me in another, or, like, the Flyfire thing. You could record a dancer in one room and broadcast them in three-dimensional space. You know, I think basically if with the spatial computing stuff, I think that's sort of inevitable. I don't know how close I am, but the spatial media is definitely coming around. And as soon as, you know, like, I'm covering football and, like, consumption media, I'm covering shopping as well. But as soon as, you know, gaming and, like, sports and porn hook up into three-dimensional spaces, it's... you know, that's still a ways off, but as soon as we get those AR goggles actually working, if that actually happens.
It'll fall into place then.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, and great panel.
Yeah, no problem. The physical, visual versus physical, I like that slide. So we have all these skills with 3D perception that, like, I know what's behind me even though I'm not looking at it, right? And this is sort of, that knowledge is sort of a non-intuitive piece of perception that you, it is an intuitive piece of perception for me to know that there's something behind me. But if you think about that that experience from a screen perspective, it's really unintuitive, right? Screens, everything's always in front of you. So the removal of the visual and the replacement of the physical, I think, is a really important aspect of all this embodiment of 3D spaces, I guess. I don't know. Sort of fun to say that.
Are there any other questions? Okay. I think that's it. One more?